Welcome to Energy Law Roundup, your comprehensive weekly briefing on legal news and developments in the energy industry from Texas and across the country, always in 30 minutes or less. And now, your host for Energy Law Roundup, business litigator and oil and gas trial lawyer, Tom Charlone.
It is the week of May 21st, 2018. Again, my name is Tom Charlone. I'm a litigation partner in the Houston office of Kane Russell, Coleman & Logan, where I serve as the head of our firm's energy practice group. In this week's episode of the podcast, we're bringing you the fifth in a multi-part series of presentations that our practice group recently made to the Association of Corporate Counsel here in Texas on a variety of key and emerging issues impacting the oil and gas industry. Today, my partner Marcy Rothman is going to talk to us about the intersection of the oil patch and the law surrounding condemnation and eminent domain. Marcy manages KRCL's Houston office and has been practicing law for 30 years. She's personally participated in over 100 trials, two-thirds of which she has handled as lead trial counsel. Marcy is literally one of the most experienced trial lawyers practicing in the state of Texas today. She regularly tries cases and has never had a result outside the predicted range. Clients trust Marcy to zealously advocate for their legal interests based upon her clear understanding of both the law and their business priorities. Marcy began her practice in Beaumont, Texas, during the heyday of Jefferson County as a plaintiff's venue. She worked in the refineries, plants, shipyards, and waterways in that area at a time when no other women were working there in heavy industry. She responds 24/7 as part of GO teams, providing legal, incident management, and investigations support for catastrophic incidents involving shipyards, oil and gas rigs, pipelines, railroads, trucking, and downstream facilities. Marcy is one of the leading transportation lawyers in the nation, and she has a special practice emphasis on the law surrounding heavy equipment, trucking, and railroads. She sits on the executive committee of the National Association of Railroad Trial Counsel, and Marcy is routinely called upon by Fortune 100 transportation companies when they face existential crises and bet the company litigation. Genuine trial lawyers are an increasingly rare breed, but Marcy is unquestionably on the short list of attorneys in Texas who can legitimately call themselves trial lawyers in the truest sense of the words. Marcy, take it away.
Hi, everybody. I'm Marcy Rothman. Good to see you today. The next thing that I'm charged with today is talking with you about eminent domain. And I guess all of us are here in the oil patch, and how many of y'all do not know what eminent domain is or condemnation? Everybody has a firm field for that? Okay, great. So what my obligation is today is to talk to you about the advancements or the new developments in eminent domain. So I thought what I would do is go through the legal developments that have occurred over 2017. And what I tried to do is I looked at the cases. Some of them don't have anything to do with the oil patch, but what I thought I would do is I would address those cases from a conceptual perspective so that you can think about how they might interact or affect your businesses. All right. So it comes to my responsibility to talk to you about the collision of two things that Texans love, heavy industry and property rights. And they collide and they impact each other directly. Eminent domain, which you are familiar with generally, is one of those areas. Texas Rise 2 is one of the premier, probably the premier eminent domain decision in 2017. It is the outgrowth of a Supreme Court decision that occurred in 2012, and it was readdressed by the Texas Supreme Court in January of 2017, and then readdressed in April of 2017 in a revised opinion. And one of the things that the Texas Rice opinion addresses is the collision of rice farmers' interests and pipeline issues for a carbon dioxide pipeline. Is anybody here associated with Denbury or Texas Rice? All right. So the big question is, who is a common carrier in Texas? And the reason that is a question is because if you are a common carrier, you have the power to condemn property. And that is what we know as eminent domain. The evidence in the Texas Rice case consisted of, and I'll tell you why I'm bringing this up in a minute. I'm not, with each case I go through, I'm not going to talk to you about the evidence that was adduced in the case, but I do want to for this particular case. And the reason is this. In Texas Rice, there was an affidavit of Denbury Green's vice president of marketing and business development. Denbury Green was formed to build, own, operate a carbon dioxide pipeline called the Green Line. The Green Line was designed to be close to refineries and plants and other industrial facilities. And it was the only available COT pipeline, and it was it has been in service since 2010. All right. So the second slide, and you'll have the materials. I'm going to, because we have a 20-minute time slot here, I'm going to sort of give you brief points from each of these slides, but you'll have the materials to deal with. So the two things that are interesting about this slide is that Denbury applied for, filed for, and received a T4 permit in order to obtain common carrier status. That's one of the ways you can do it. But they also went before the court and the in Beaumont, and Denbury was found to be a common carrier with eminent domain authority, in other words, the power to condemn property for these rice farmers in Anahuac and Winnie. And the side story is that I started my practice in Beaumont, Texas, and I represented the LNVA, which is the water authority down there. And they have these levees that go through these rice fields, and they have what they call canal riders. And the guys go in their trucks, and they will literally open the gates to flood these rice fields with water and then close the gates. And as a young lawyer, I used to ride with the canal riders. And so I know this area pretty intimately, and it's real. The rice farmers are there. They really believe in their property rights, and they're not interested in having pipelines cross them. And so that's a real thing. In any event, when Denbury Green filed for, asked for a survey in order to condemn the property, and you have to have a survey in order to issue the offers and the things that are necessary to condemn property, the Jefferson County rice farmers decided that they did not want to allow Denbury access to the property. And Denbury went and got an injunction and was permitted the authority to take a survey. And I have fought that battle before, where somebody didn't want us to take a survey, and we've had to address that. But one of the points, which is the third bullet on this particular slide, is that Denbury Green did file for an injunction to access the Jefferson County property. And they did take possession of Texas Rice's property under the provision that allows a condemnor to take property upon depositing money in the registry of the court after proceedings. So the trial court found that Denbury Green was a common carrier with eminent domain authority, and the Beaumont Court of Appeals affirmed, and the Supreme Court reversed and remanded, and they established a test that would permit Denbury Green to introduce evidence of a future customer and to demonstrate that the Green Line will indeed be used to transport for public hire. And what that means is, the next phrase, would not be limited to the facilities of the owner. So in other words, Denbury Green had to establish that they had an independent client. It couldn't be them that they were transporting the CO2 for, or whatever the pipeline was going to transmit, in this case, CO2. So you have to have a real client for the public use in order to condemn, is the point there. Because you can't condemn somebody else's property for your own use. It has to be for the public use. So after receiving the evidence that I went through with you, the affidavit and the information about where the pipeline was situated to serve clients, customers, the Beaumont Court of Appeals decided that the reasonable minds could differ on whether Denbury, at the time it decided to build the line, had a reasonable probability that they would serve the public. And what I think really happened here, and I haven't asked any of the Beaumont Court of Appeals judges. I used to know them all, and I could just ask them. But I haven't been down there lately, and I haven't raised the question with them. But what I think probably happened, and I don't think they would necessarily agree with this or admit this, but what I think probably happened is that when this case went up to the Court of Appeals, and the Beaumont elected officials, the elected judges, were faced with the prospect of deciding whether Denbury or whether the rice farmers, the tax base or the voters, had the enough evidence to determine what would happen with the property. I suspect that the Court of Appeals decided to punt, and they called it a fact issue, and they sent it back to the court to make a jury make the determination of whether or not it was really a common carrier. In other words, whether there was really an intent to serve the public. And the Texas Supreme Court said in its second opinion, which was issued on January the 6th and revised on April the 7th, that in order to qualify as a common carrier with eminent domain power, a reasonable probability must exist that the pipeline will at some point after construction serve the public. And what serving the public means is that it has to transport gas for one or more customers who will retain ownership of it. So it has to be a real customer is the point of that. And it also there also has to be a reasonable probability that that customer will exist. Mere possibility is not enough. And that is Texas Rice. So these are the way I position this talk is for each new topic. That's Texas Rice. For each new topic, I made a faceplate here so that you could see what generally I was going to talk about. And I told you I was going to try to make sure that there were some relatable principles to your business, even if these cases were not oil and gas. So I want to make sure you're familiar with them. I also mentioned the jurisdiction because I think it's important to think about what jurisdictions decide things how. And so the next set of cases are called Jones and Muhammad, and the East Texas appellate courts affirm the jurisdictional rules that require timely objections to eminent domain awards in order to support various appeals. So eminent domain condemnation proceedings are a statutory animal. They are governed by rules that are made by the legislature. The jurisdiction of the courts are specific and they are dictated by the Texas Property Code. And if you break those rules, you are without relief. And that is a very important thing to know. If there are dates that are prescribed, there are deadlines that are prescribed, and there are proceedings that are prescribed by the Texas Property Code. And it is important to have people who understand that procedure. Otherwise, you're going to lose valuable rights. And Jones and Muhammad are address, they are 2017 cases that address things that I think probably people should already know. But nonetheless, the appellate court issued, the appellate courts issued opinions on them. So I thought I'd mention them to you. Jones is a Texarkana case. Let's see. Jones is a Texarkana case versus Plains Pipeline. It was issued in January of 2017. And Plains Pipeline sought an easement across some property in Woods County. Jones owned an undivided interest in the land and didn't want to sell. Plains filed a condemnation proceeding, and Jones missed the deadline to object. The commissioner's award findings and award were filed with the district court. Just like a regular state district court case, you have 20 days after the Monday next to file an objection. Mr. Jones missed the objection, and he appealed. And the second, third, and fourth bullet point on the slide that's before you right now establish sort of the general rules. Any power of the court to act as special and depends on the eminent domain statute. In Texas, again, it's Chapter 21 to the Property Code. There are federal court condemnation proceedings. They are not used very typically. We've done some unique and creative work using the federal condemnation statutes, but it is a very, very rare thing to see a federal condemnation. Our work around that had to do with an effort to address a cemetery that some landowners platted and declared in order to prevent us from taking some property in Central Texas. A cemetery is one thing if it is a legitimate cemetery, a legitimate dedicated cemetery that you cannot condemn over. And so one of the things that happened when my client was creating a very large, that multi-thousand acre process project was that a landowner, a recalcitrant landowner who did not want to sell his property or otherwise negotiate his property, dedicated a cemetery. And what we did was we used the federal process and we also used some agency rules, and we established that the cemetery was not a real cemetery and that it was a block, and we were able to address the exposure that way. If we had not been successful in that regard, a multi-thousand acre process that was already underway would have been interrupted. So the second rule, which is bullet point three, is that if a party doesn't timely object to the commissioner's finding an award, the court's function is purely ministerial, and the court must adopt the findings of the commissioners as its judgment. And the third thing is the thing that I have told you that I think is already pretty self-evident, and I think it should be if you read the rules, that the failure to file objections renders the trial court judgment not appealable and the appellate court does not have jurisdiction. Another case involving Jones, involving Plains Pipeline, came out of Tyler. So that was, sorry, that's Tyler. The preceding case was Texarkana. And something fairly similar happened. Plains filed a condemnation action against Muhammad in Smith County. and sought easement rights, and Muhammad appeared, and there was a $3,000 award, and he missed the appellate deadline, and the court dismissed for want of jurisdiction. It's pretty simple, but there are still, in 2017, cases being written on that particular point. Enbridge. The point of this, so we've talked about East Texas, now we're talking about Corpus Christi, as you see on the faceplate there. And the point of this particular Enbridge case is that we have to be very, very careful in condemnation to identify the right parties. There are title issues, there are ownership issues, there are recordation issues that it can affect the legitimacy of an eminent domain proceeding, a condemnation proceeding. And it's important to stay ahead of those issues, and they can be very difficult. So in this case, the opinion was issued in June of 2017. Saratoga conveyed to Batson an exclusive pipeline and easement in Hardin County, and Batson recorded it. Now, one thing that I noticed when reading this case is that it's out of Corpus Christi, but it's in Hardin County. The property's in Hardin County. And so what I think probably happened, and I haven't gone back and checked, but what I think probably happened is that this case was decided under a appellate court equalization rule. So Hardin County is in East Texas. It's just north of Beaumont. And typically, a Hardin County appeal would be heard by the Beaumont Court of Appeals. There are equalization rules at the appellate court level. When one appellate court has a heavy docket, the cases will be equalized to make sure that the appellate process is smooth and a little more timely. I suspect that without checking, that this case was under the equalization, because there's no reason why a Corpus Christi case would have heard a Hardin County dispute. But that's just a side note. After that, Enbridge filed a condemnation action in Hardin County seeking easements over the Batson easement interest. Saratoga did not appear, which of itself in the eminent domain proceeding would not signal anything of concern. In order to challenge the right to take, there are certain procedural rules, and sometimes the party being condemned does not appear at the special commissioner's hearing. So by itself, that would not raise any red flags. The special commissioners granted Enbridge a pipeline easement and awarded Saratoga $33,500. Well, Saratoga then files a plea to the jurisdiction saying, "You don't have jurisdiction over me," and objects to the decision and the award. Enbridge files an alternative pleading and adds Batson. Now, why would Saratoga do this? And why would Enbridge do this? Well, probably what happened is Saratoga realized that it had just been given a $33,500 award for a piece of property that it did not have any rights on. I'll explain why in a minute. And Enbridge probably went, "Oh my goodness, Batson has a recorded interest in this easement that we've just taken, and we did not initiate the condemnation proceedings against Batson." So what Enbridge tried to do was add Batson without going through the special commissioner's proceeding. They just added him to the lawsuit that results with an objection. Is anybody here an expert on eminent domain? Anybody here particularly experienced with it? Just curious. All right. So what happens next is the court grants Saratoga's plea to the jurisdiction. Enbridge objects. They apparently want to get relief from the special commissioner's findings and the final order now that orders them to pay Saratoga $33,500. And their objection is that Saratoga has no interest in the land. Why? The one piece I didn't tell you about is that Saratoga had conveyed all of its interests, separate apart from what it had given to Batson in easement, to a company called Timbervest while the lawsuit was pending. So now what you have is you have a judgment in favor of Saratoga for $33,500. It doesn't own any interest in the real estate. And Batson, who owns the easement that Enbridge was trying to condemn, is not a proper party to the case. Holy smokes. Not a good result. So what happens is that the court notes that Saratoga's deed to Timbervest conveys all of its rights subject to Batson's easement. The Court of Appeals bails out Enbridge. They say, "You know what? We've looked at the record around the relationship that Saratoga has with Timbervest, and we find that Saratoga conveyed all of its interest to Timbervest. and therefore doesn't have any rights to the condemnation award. The deed conveyed the land and accepted Batson's easement and the condemnation lawsuit. So that's what it did with Saratoga. And with Batson, it sort of punted, the Court of Appeals punted. And what they said was that the issue wasn't briefed fully enough. So I have, someday soon, I'll go back and see what happened with Batson. I'll pull up the court records. But the bottom line is that what I think probably had to happen is that Enbridge had to go back and restart special commissioner's proceedings and eminent domain proceedings against Batson. City of Dallas. North Texas court, this is a North Texas Court of Appeals, provides guidance on how to handle production business with governmental entities. In February of 2017, Trinity sued the city alleging, well, that's when the opinion came out, but the facts underlying this are that Trinity sued the city alleging that the city leased mineral rights to Trinity on city property for the purpose of drilling for oil and gas. What's important to know is that the property that was involved here is parkland and other sort of recreational use areas. I'll tell you why in a minute. The city leased the minerals to Trinity. Why? Because Dallas was having a budget shortfall. So they thought, well, we'll do a little production, a little exploration, a little production, and we'll generate some revenue. Trinity asked for pre-approval of the drill sites. City refused, but the city reassured Trinity that we'll give you future approvals in the ordinary course of business. Trinity paid $19 million. They prepared the geotesting. They did design the drill sites, roads, pipelines, Corps of Engineers approval. And then the Planning Commission denies the applications. $19 million worth of investments and your applications are denied. Explain that to the board. Trinity sues and claims breach of contract and inverse condemnation, and the city claims governmental immunity. Can't sue the city. The city says, Trinity says, no. You weren't acting in your governmental capacity. You were acting in your proprietary capacity. You were basically trying to make a deal and earn some money. And the court found that making leases is proprietary. And remember I told you about the parklands and the floodplains, the recreational areas? Even though the Planning Commission made a resolution and talked about parklands and floodplains being its primary concern, the court still found that the leases were proprietary and that the fact that the property involved was parkland and floodplains was not sufficient to make this a governmental function. So what happened was the Court of Appeals found that the cause of action was actionable. They found that the claim for inverse condemnation was viable because the Intentional Government Act resulted in uncompensated taking of property. So I guess the lesson from that is if you're going to do business with a governmental agency, make sure that you have your permissions tamped down and your approvals. And if, for example, if it's in the Houston area, you have your commissioner's court approval or whatever your particular municipality form of government is, make sure you have that addressed in advance. The law is a seamless web, and a question just occurred to me as I was standing here talking to you, and I will go back and look at it. And the question is, if the court found that it was a proprietary act and not a governmental act, then why does it permit inverse condemnation under the idea that it's an intentional governmental act? Maybe I'm reading too much into that, but I need to think about that for a minute. So Mount Vernon Church, this is the Houston court. So we've been to East Texas, we've been to the Supreme Court, we've been to Corpus Christi, we've been to Tyler, we've been to Texarkana, we've been to Dallas, and now we're in Houston. And the Houston court affirms that a lien holder may participate in eminent domain proceeds, but must first exhaust any administrative remedies. So the way this case worked, it's an April 2017 opinion. The way this case worked is that Harris County condemned church property and deposited money in the registry of the court. The taxing authorities sought to recover for ad valorem and demolition lien debt relating to the property. And the trial court issued an order permitting the withdrawal of the funds. The church argued that the lien was extinguished. And what happened? The standard for review of court orders regarding the disbursement of funds is abuse of discretion. That means that somebody arguing that the court has improperly permitted the release of funds must show that it was an arbitrary and capricious act. That means that's a very high standard. It's very hard to show. You have to show that there's no rational relationship between what the court did and the law. In this case, the Court of Appeals in Houston found that upon the deposit of the condemnation proceeds in the registry of the court, the lien holder's security interests in the condemned property vest in the condemnation awards. So somebody holding a lien can take from the condemnation awards. We know that. Here's the other piece. There was a tax question, and the church raised a question about its tax status. And the court said, sorry, you first have to address that through the administrative remedies that are available to you. So if you have a tax question or some other kind of question that has an avenue for administrative relief, and you're looking either at a condemnation and what to do with proceeds, or if you're the condemning authority, depending on who you are here, then one of the things that you should do before you conclude your action and before you ask for any distribution, you should look at the administrative avenues available for everybody who's got at least an ostensible interest in the proceeds. That's my slide about the cemetery example. We've already talked about that. North Texas, again, KMS retail. This is a retail and municipal issue, but it may provide some information for you on how you develop your property. KMS, this is also in Dallas, City of Rowlett, Dallas Court of Appeals. KMS owned a parcel of land that included a private road, and it was built on a private road easement. The City of Rowlett entered into a development agreement with Briarwood to develop property near a facility called Luke's Landing, but Briarwood did not have a way to access the property. And Briarwood had an obligation to build a drive and some drainage. Oh, there it is, a drive and a drainage culvert. And so Briarwood went, in order to fulfill its obligation to the City of Rowlett, it went to KMS. It was landlocked. It went to KMS and asked KMS for permission to cross its property in order to do what it needed to do in terms of building some the improvements that are cited there. And KMS and Briarwood did not agree. So the city moved to condemn. And KMS, the city adjusted its agreement with Briarwood to reflect the cost of condemnation, and KMS screeched. And they said, hold on a minute. You are condemning our property so that you can do a deal with another private landowner for development. That is not an appropriate use of the condemnation authority. Well, what did the courts say? A pretext or a subterfuge is, I have seen that in a number of condemnation proceedings, including some pretty big ones involving major Texas counties. This is a very interesting opinion. It's something we see from time to time. Here's what the court said. The court overruled KMS's argument that a public necessity is not the same as for the public good. And it noted that the city made a formal resolution saying that the taking was for the creation of a public street. And it submitted an affidavit saying that the condemnation was necessary to alleviate traffic congestion and hazards. And it said that this was it specifically said that this was not, hold on a minute, let me back it up here. It specifically said that notwithstanding the fact that there was going to be a private benefit, the fact that there was an affidavit on file from the city that said that this was for the creation of public street and for the purpose of alleviating traffic congestion and hazard was sufficient. And so the bottom line is the Court of Appeals, it found a way around the pretext argument. And it went ahead and did what it wanted, what the city wanted to do. I don't know what the local politics were involved in this, but there usually is some. And so these are issues to be aware of. Thank you very much.
Thank you for listening to Energy Law Roundup. If you would like additional information about anything from today's episode, you can contact Tom at 210-446-6999 or by email at tom@charlone.net. New episodes of this podcast are available every week on the web at www.energylawroundup.com, your one-stop source for breaking news and developments in energy law.